jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey! Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. O'er the fields we go, laughing all the way.
Episode of the Ed Shep Radio Experiment. This show is the Ed Shep Radio Experiment's Holiday Geektacular. There'll be lots of
merry music, festive facts,
and enormous amounts of your favorite king of the pumpkin beaters, Ed Shep. Ed Shep. Ed Shep. So I hope you've got your Santa hat on and your Christmas cookies at hand, because you're in for another Chris Manu Kwanzamadan-a-thon starting right now. 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 Christmas. A lot of people think that the Christmas of today, with its tree, presents, Santa Claus, and spoonberry pudding, has always been around, and has always been celebrated just how it is today. And they're right, in Arizona. But then we all know that everyone in Arizona is wrong. Now you say it. Everyone in Arizona is wrong.
Good.
Christmas, in fact, dates back only to the 13th century, when in the year 1444, the Catholic Church declared it the celebration of the birth of Jesus. The Church did so to take attention away from the ancient Festival of the Children, which had been celebrated since the Roman era. In the ironically named Festival of the Children, all the parents cut pine or cypress branches off the trees in the village and whipped their children with them in the town square. Then they all went off to a great feast to praise the Roman god of discipline, Dilipidu. The Catholic Church took several aspects of the holiday and reinvented them to suit their purposes. The pine switches became a tree that symbolized the strength and pine saw freshness of the church. The focus on children turned to the focus on the baby Jesus. And the great feast remained, but the praise was for God and the saints instead of Dilipidu, who after the holiday's replacement quickly faded away, proving the phrase, "If you ignore it, it will go away." Over the next 1,000 years, the holiday continued to evolve, but wouldn't become revolutionized until the appearance of Santa Claus in 1698. Originally an avalanche that evolved into an abominable snowman, Santa Claus roamed the earth until a tribe of canary pigeons enslaved and domesticated him. Santa Claus grew into a fine human being under their care, and after he escaped and fled to the North Pole, he assumed his current tradition of spreading toys to the world's children. Incorporating Santa Claus into the fabric of modern Christmas wasn't long in doing. Soon there were many myths and stories about him, including the entirely fallacious story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, originally an anti-Native American racist pamphlet that grew into a heartwarming holiday tale in the space of just a few decades. The tradition of gift-giving for Christmas began in the mid-20th century, when the American government purchased Christmas from the Catholic Church for $29 million in a bag of beads and trinkets, after which the Americans declared the holiday what it remains today, Christmas, the celebration of the almighty dollar. Today, Christmas has officially become its own corporation, with stock that fluctuates but generally offers a good return. Many multinational corporations are heavily invested in Christmas, and every year push its celebration forward to maximize profits over the previous year. While periodically some groups call for a return to the ancient Roman celebration, modern Christmas shows no signs of slowing anytime soon, and is expected to swallow up Halloween within a decade, and Valentine's Day within two.
Seatbelts, everybody! Put on your food belts! Oh, no, it's not that time of year again! No, it can't be! It can't be! Tell me, pinch me! Tell me it's not here!
It's the most fattening time of the year. Of the year.
This the truth, too. They got this new holiday out now called Kwanzaa. I have never figured what that is. And every year it come up the same time. And we go through the same procedure year after year. On the first day of Kwanzaa, my children come up and ask me. They say, "Mama, what in the hell is Kwanzaa for?" And see, I don't know. Now, on the second day of Kwanzaa, I schedule a wrestling match. Me and that perpendicular-head lady go after it, honey, and I usually bust her upside of her head. Now, on the third day of Kwanzaa, everybody goes down to the stove. Gotta get some malt liquor, 5 lotto tickets. Honey, you never know who's gonna win that thing. You have to play to win. That's when Kwanzaa start to feel real to me. It'd be more like a feeling of the heart. I know that's right. Where my cigarettes at?
Police, stop my car. Police, stop my car. The police locked me up, 'cause when I blew a 2.1.
Christmas gifts
from the future.
Have you ever wondered what Christmas gifts you'll be receiving in the year 2020? You don't have to wonder anymore, because the Ed Shep Radio Experiment has the answer. After consulting a numberless number of futurologists, fortune tellers, scientists, and old blowhards, we arrived at a definitive list of the most popular Christmas presents in the year 2020, the 25th century. Here's our list of the gifts all of us will be aching to receive in the years to come. Topping the list is this most unexpected gift. Comedy club tickets. Yes, and I know what you're thinking, and the FCC won't let me air most of the words in your head right now either. But experts tell us comedy clubs in the future will be so different from how they are now that if you walked into one of them now, you wouldn't know where you were. Apparently, comedy clubs in the future will be wonderful places, virtual heavens on earth. They'll be buildings made of ultra-delicious candy, filled with super-oxygenated air, spiked with seasonally appropriate designer drugs. And everyone who works there will be beautiful, intelligent, and magnetic. Literally, because they'll all be robots, specially made for the comedy club industry. Going to a comedy club in the future will be like dropping acid and ecstasy and riding Space Mountain with Andy Dick and Laura Keitlinger. Of course, all this pleasure will come at a huge price, so that only the very rich will be able to go to one with any frequency. One thing about comedy clubs will remain the same, however. There will still be stand-up comedians. But since scientists will have decoded and sequenced humor completely, the performers will actually be funny. Now that's science at work. Another popular holiday gift of the future will be depression.
What happened?
You say? That's right, depression. Or more accurately, a sadness pill. You see, prognosticators all agree that advances in psychiatry, technology, genetics, and everything else will create a world where negative emotions don't exist. So people will create them with short-acting pills that impart a somber, sad mood. People will take them to spend a night at home grieving and reading Sylvia Plath or Elizabeth Wurtzel, or listening to poignant music such as the classic funeral dirge, Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer.
Obligatory excerpt.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for being Grandma, we believe.
In 2020, when someone asks you how your Christmas was, and you respond that it was terribly depressing, they will glow with envy. Literally, because mood clothing will be huge that year. Another coveted gift in the future, a race lift. In the future, people will change their race as often as people now change their face. Racism will have completely disappeared in the year 2020, when ethnicity will become something like a fashion statement. Races will go in and out of fashion, with some becoming classics and others being relegated to mere fad status. In the future, also, there will be many more races than there are now. They will come in numerous shapes and colors, and even patterns. Purportedly, British car magnate Burberry is already at work patenting a race of people with Burberry-patterned skin. Today, perfume and cologne are classic Christmas gifts, beloved and cherished by all, and anyone who doesn't love and cherish them hates flowers and puppies and the beach and America. In the future, perfume remains the ecstatic Christmas gift it is today, except that everyone on Earth wears it, and does so much more than they do now. In the future, smart perfume will come on the scene, which will be able to change your mood through nano-micronized particles dissolved in it. But that's not all. Perfumes will also be on the market which will react with your body chemistry to produce your own electrostatic force field, which can power your computer or personal appliances, propel you through the air, or protect you from predators. Many perfumes and colognes in the future will also make you smarter, as they will have billions of terabytes of information dissolved in them in tiny neuro-nanomodulatory U-chemicals, which access data ports in your nervous system and make you smarter. Imagine being able to learn the entire works of Shakespeare by just finishing a single bottle of cologne. That sure smells promising. It goes without saying that neural upgrades will be a popular Christmas gift in the future. Common stocking stuffers will include microchips that dissolve on your tongue or in other orifices, and will enhance your brain power or sense sensitivity by incorporating into your circuitry, either your natural circuitry or any technological upgrades you may have. And that's our survey of Christmas gifts
from the future.
Ed Shep presents
Observations by Ed Shep.
Ding.
Christmas time in Manhattan is beautiful. From the tree in Rockefeller Center, to the windows in Bergdorf, to the big red bow around the Cartier building, it's really one of the best times to be in the city. But as nice as it is to be in New York for the holiday season, there's nothing quite like spending the actual holiday itself in Florida. There's no other place I'd rather be for Christmas. Sure, I know what you're thinking.
Christmas isn't Christmas without snow, or at least very cold weather.
And I admit, I used to think the same thing. I think most of us feel that way when we're young. But you reach a certain age and it occurs to you that seasons kinda suck. All the changing of clothes, sloshing around in the snow, who needs it? How much better to spend Christmas in a place where you only need to throw on a light jacket, if that, to go outside and look at people's light displays, or to feel the bright sun on your face while coming out of the huge mall, which is crowded, but not Manhattan crowded. And think about how nice it is just to go outside and cut some berries or juniper for your holiday centerpiece, or even just to spend the whole day outside digging a hole. It's a joy. So much better than slopping through dirty snow in dense crowds and lugging huge packages through the subway, all in that classic northeastern winter dreariness. And of course, what's better than spending a day after Christmas getting loaded on the 2-hour flight from Florida to New York? I should mention at this point that a good part of what makes spending Christmas in Florida so appealing for me is being there with my family. And also being able to leave before it gets too boring or annoying. I never really thought that spending time with the family would actually be a selling point, but I guess that's another when you reach a certain age thing. In fact, I remember our father telling us kids that we would feel that way one day, but at the time I didn't believe it. Then again, he also told us that there was a Scrooge Part 2, wherein the spirits visited Scrooge a second time to warn him against being too free with his money and being taken advantage of. I never found evidence of the existence of that story, but the part about family in the end does ring true. And so does the fact that Christmas is just better in Florida.
Observations by Ed Shep. I saw Daddy kissing Santa Claus underneath a mistletoe last night. He didn't see me.
Let's talk about one Christmas time I spent in Atlanta. It was 2003 and I had gotten laid off from my job a few months before. After weeks of mulling over whether I should finally give up this crazy New York experiment and move back to Atlanta, I decided I would and made arrangements to stay with my friend Nolan in his spare room indefinitely. I knew it was not the ideal arrangement. The house was in a neighborhood best described as developing, and Nolan could get very annoying in steady doses. But I'd have my own room, I could borrow one of his cars until I got mine own, and while it was a bit of a trek, the house was accessible by public transportation. I flew into Atlanta a week before Christmas. I'd planned to fly home for the holiday and then return to begin my job hunt
full force.
And if it was really bad there, I could always just return to New York. But I didn't expect that to happen. When I arrived, the city was enduring an unusual cold snap, like much of the East. It was so cold, in fact, that if I hadn't been fully awake during the flight, I would have thought that the plane simply circled over LaGuardia and landed again in New York. But in spite of the freezing temperatures, I was excited. I hadn't seen Nolan in some time, and Atlanta in years. I was eager to revisit my old haunts and couldn't wait to drive around with Nolan and catch up on everything. When we arrived at Nolan's house, I received my first disillusionment.
The first disillusionment.
While I thought I'd be staying in his spare room, that was not the case. I was assigned to the sofa in the overcluttered living room, right next to the drafty window. And of course, the sofa did not fold out. I couldn't remember if Nolan had told me that the person in the spare room was still living there, but I don't think he had, because I doubt I'd have moved back there if I thought I'd be sleeping on an uncomfortable non-fold-out sofa. My next disillusionment came the next morning when I went to take a shower. Nolan told me before I came that he was renovating the bathroom and that there was no shower, but by the time I arrived there would be. Of course there wasn't. But what was also missing was a chrome faucet in the bathtub. There was only a thin copper pipe jutting out from the wall, which shot out water when you turned it on. Thankfully, it didn't gush beyond the edge of the tub. While bathing there for the first time, I can genuinely say that I felt like Paris Hilton in The Simple Life, except without the cameras, the rich friend, or the credit cards which would enable me to escape. The evening offered up a third disillusionment. I somehow managed to convince Nolan, even in the face of his prodigious whining, to drive me out to Target to pick up some things. I didn't need to get anything so much as I just wanted to get out of the house and see some of the city. I looked forward to visiting a certain Target I reminisced about with Nolan, one located near Midtown, right next to a Taco Bell and near some interesting neighborhoods that maybe we could drive through. It would be the first time we'd have entered the perimeter of the city, and I was excited. Of course, the Target Nolan chose to drive to was very different, one in a region outside the city that you might call Redneckville, if you were so inclined. His rationale was that he did not want to battle the traffic, in spite of the fact that it was around 7 p.m. and the roads would not have been densely crowded. I was disappointed and failed to see the point in going to a Target that felt like a Walmart. The whole reason of paying a bit more at Target is because the clientele and atmosphere doesn't remind you so vividly of your own poverty. At least, that's usually the point of Target. This Target seemed the exception. After that, the disillusionments came with greater frequency. Nolan lived much farther out than I realized, and the public transportation in his area wasn't exactly pleasant. Nolan whined more often than I remembered, and never wanted to do anything after he'd come home from work. Nolan had acquired a large dog with mange that stayed out on the front porch, etc., etc. But I think the moment I definitely realized that the situation was unworkable came a few nights before my departure for Florida, at which point I'd still not acquired my plane ticket home. You see, Nolan was someone who could have been an Olympic gold medalist if only cheapness were a competition in the games. He could probably beat out Ebenezer Scrooge himself. And one thing that he refused to spend beyond the bare minimum on was heating. I remember sitting at home with his roommates during the day shivering in a jacket, because if anyone put on the heat, Nolan would throw a bitching fit, another one of his sterling talents. One night, when the mercury had sunk to around 24 degrees, Nolan insisted that someone had turned up the heat and launched into a fit, and in the midst of his performance ripped the heating unit out of the wall. And if that weren't enough, Nolan had friends over drinking that night, and one in particular, whose name was Griselda, had gotten so drunk that she passed out right there on the kitchen floor. Someone laid her jacket over her, but in the cold and with her being so intoxicated, I was convinced that if she didn't have at least a few more blankets, she would certainly die of hypothermia, and we would all be dealing with one enormous dead alcoholic on the kitchen floor the next morning. Not very merry for me. So I gave her some of my blankets and tried to sleep on the sofa, with all the clothes I could muster on for warmth. Over the next couple days, I scrambled to get my plane tickets, the return flight for which I booked to New York, and scrambled again to get a car to the airport in case Nolan got drunk the night before and flaked out on me. I remember being very nervous the night before the flight, as I was extremely eager to get out of that house and neighborhood, and I actually got out my miniature Buddha, lit some candles, and started chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, because I figured it couldn't hurt and could only help the situation. The next day came, and my flight went off without a hitch, and although I didn't leave Nolan's house under the best terms, we're good friends again today. A couple thousand miles of distance was exactly what the friendship needed. I should mention that the whole time I was in Atlanta, I missed New York terribly. I even had lucid dreams about flying over Manhattan and the like. And while I even had a brief flirtation with the West Coast for a few weeks later that winter, I still found myself back here in Manhattan eventually, in spite of everything my better judgment told me. And so this crazy New York experiment continues on, and I guess I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yes, I did.
The very next day, you gave it away.
Yeah, yeah.
This year, see.
I'll give it to someone special.
Yeah, yeah, we got the sound, make the world go round. Yo, it's 9-8, still. To go to store on top of your tree, cause home with your family is where you wanna be.
Little sis and big bro, building angels in the snow, waiting by the door for your man under the mistletoe.
2-4 represent, so don't miss this. We got the gift to gab wrapped up just for Christmas.
Last Christmas, I'll give you my heart.
Went to the store, sat on Santa's lap, asked him to bring my friends all kinds of crap.
Christmas language lesson. Gloria in excelsis Deo is Latin for glory to God in the highest. Gloria being the word for glory, in excelsis meaning in the highest, and Deo meaning to God. Latin has something called a declension, which means that the endings of words change according to how they're used in sentences. In this sentence, Gloria, because it is the subject, is in the nominative case, which in some sense is the default case in Latin. It's the case in which you first learn the words. The word for God in the nominative case is Deus. In this sentence, it appears in the dative case, which is generally used for indirect objects. Latin words are gendered, and because Deus is masculine, it ends in the dative case with an O. Based on this lesson, if you wanted to say, glory to Ed in the highest, how would you say it?
How would you say it?
How would you say it? Remember that masculine words end in O in the dative case, and that male names are generally masculine. How would you say it?
How would you say it?
How would you say it? Take a moment for your answer. Did you say Gloria in excelsis Edo? If you did, then you're right!
You're right!
You're right! You're right! Incidentally, you probably noticed the sonic similarity between the two sentences.
Deo Edo.
After a while, they start to sound exactly the same. Coincidence? I think not. And that's your Christmas language lesson.
Hello and season's greetings from the White Stripes. This is Meg White.
Oh, holy infant, so tender and mild.
Holy infant, so tender and mild. Sleep in heavenly peace. Sleep in heavenly peace.
Good job.
Jack, it is round yon virgin.
Yeah, you're right. It's round yon virgin. I was wrong.
I'd like to take a moment to talk about a serious threat to society today, one that is especially prevalent around the holidays and in the southern parts of the country. I'm talking about middle-aged women making holiday sweatshirts with fabric paint.
I made it myself.
Generally, this practice involves generic red, green, or white sweatshirts decorated with simple designs in fabric paint, with even simpler messages, such as, "Have a holly jolly Christmas," or "Jesus is the reason for the season." Sometimes these monstrosities even involve glitter and beads. These sweatshirts are an affront to beauty. They are a disgrace to every idea of good taste and must be stopped. To help stop these travesties, I propose limiting the sale of fabric paint to licensed professionals and to the general public as prescription only. After the materials are available to the general public only by prescription, it will be easy to spot chronic abusers of fabric paint and get them the treatment they so desperately need. If you believe in beauty, in making the world a more pleasant place to look at, please write your congressman or representative today and urge them to support the Ed Shep Fabric Paint Abuse Prevention Initiative, or ESPAPI. Remember. Stop the insanity. Only you can prevent fabric paint abuse. Friends, don't let friends use fabric paint. Just say no to fabric paint. This is your brain on fabric paint. And as John Lennon once famously said, imagine no fabric paint. Imagine.
chipmunks roasting on an open fire. Screw you.
Did you hear that, Melvin? Melvin? Melvin!
Why, I'm sorry, Dave. Did you want Melvin? There's plenty of Thagador left, though.
The story of the Amaryllis. Have you ever wondered why the Amaryllis is a traditional holiday plant? You have, really? Well, why is actually a wonderful story, and I'm going to share it with you right now. Right now. Right now. Right now. Right now. Long, long ago, in the year 1971, there lived an evil sorceress near the North Pole who despised the color red. She avoided the color at all costs and killed anything red that grew on the frozen land near her home. Why she hated red, no one knew for sure, though some people theorized that she had been ruthlessly made fun of for her red hair as a child, which now had turned white, and that to avoid memories of that trauma, she banished the color from her life forever. The evil sorceress was named Cher. Cher had succeeded in removing every trace of red from her life, except one. Every Christmas Eve, Santa and his reindeer would fly over her ice castle, low enough for Rudolph's red nose to illuminate everything below in bright crimson. And every year, Cher vowed to destroy Rudolph and Santa's entire crew. Near Cher lived a group of kind snow fairies who got gifts from Santa and loved him very much. One of the fairies, whose name was Amaryllis, was deeply in love with Rudolph, and every year watched for him and left him a box of wine as a Christmas token. Amaryllis knew of Cher's evil plan, but wasn't worried at all by it, since Cher had never tried to stop Santa before. But in 1971, Cher had got a new, powerful rocket launcher for her birthday, and decided to test it out on Christmas Eve. She waited for Santa's sleigh to come around, and when it did, she shot it out of the sky. Santa and the reindeer all fell to the ground and scattered. Luckily for Cher, Rudolph landed directly in her lair, and she immediately trapped him. Amaryllis was watching for Rudolph that year and witnessed the entire event. She rushed to the scene, where she found Cher standing over a book of spells reciting. Amaryllis knew what she had to do. She grabbed a small bag of pepper and flew up to just below Cher's nose. Then she released the pepper, causing Cher to sneeze violently and stop reciting her spell. While Cher was sneezing, Amaryllis quickly turned her spellbook several pages ahead, so that when Cher finished her spell, something unexpected happened. Instead of Rudolph turning into a tiny black stone, as the original spell would have had it, Cher herself exploded into millions of tiny seeds, which flew all over the ground around her ice castle, and all sprouted immediately into huge red and white flowers. Then Amaryllis freed Rudolph and reunited him with Santa, and Christmas was saved. Later the next year, Amaryllis and Rudolph were married and had a freak half-reindeer, half-fairy child that went on to have a successful career in the circus. And the flowers around Cher's ice castle bloomed every Christmas thereafter. And they were named Amaryllis, after the fairy who saved Rudolph. And the flowers are still grown today, and given at Christmas to remember Amaryllis' love for Rudolph. And that is the story of the Amaryllis.
"'Twas the night before Christmas.
Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-wolf open sleigh. Well, dashing through the snow, where is that reindeer with the red nose?
It's 9:30 on the night before Christmas. Tomorrow you'll work a double shift because that lying idiot Annie says she's sick again. And of course you'll be blamed for whatever goes wrong tomorrow, and you know something will because it always does.
Your feet are cold and frozen from trudging around in the dirty sludge snow. And the special present you bought for your friend who nursed you through that bad stomach flu is either broken or ruined from when it fell into that puddle of unidentifiable composition when someone pushed you. Your scarf blew away and your jacket tore when it caught on a stray piece of metal in a store that didn't even have what you needed. You have a slight headache, your hands are numb from the cold that your cheap gloves don't protect you from, and you feel another cold sore coming on. But you're still standing there, in that subway station that smells like a poor neighborhood in Calcutta, glowing with Yuletide joy. Because through those dollar store headphones you're wearing streams a voice of love and hope, warming your heart with the spirit of the season and reminding you of all the good things that life can bring.
You could notice, three wise men abruptly entered at the barn. Wonder Woman grabbed a broom to attack them, but they explained that a leprechaun had appeared to them too and told them to come to the newborn child. The wise men's names were Dracula, Cupid, and Frosty the Snowman. They came to
this holiday season, fall in love all over again with Ed Shep.
Merry Christmas, darling.
This has been the Ed Shep Radio Experiment. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. This is Ed Shep signing off.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.